Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight I want to welcome Charles Koss. He has a PhD in medieval history, which involved the hunt for the historic Robin Hood. He is an author and has written a book on worldwide pyramids, exposing them as symbolic tombs of Loki, the fallen astronaut. His second book, Confessions of the Gods, provides evidence of a lost high-tech civilization. Charles, welcome. How are you doing tonight?
Hi, Chris. Great to be with you. I'm doing great. It's a damn hot day here today. Really hot, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I bet. I've heard about the tremendous heat wave that's been going on over there with all the wildfires. It's pretty getting pretty bad out there. Hope everything's okay in your area.
It's all fine here, but we're getting smoke from different states. So one hot day we had smoke from New South Wales, and just yesterday we had smoke from Tasmania. Apparently Tasmania is becoming engulfed as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's terrible. Terrible stuff. But tonight we're gonna have some fun. We're going to talk some of my favorite stuff, forbidden history, ancient advanced technology, ancient beings, civilizations, megalithic structures, so much more. But let's start with a little bit more about you. Tell us about more about your background and what got you started down this path.
Okay, well, I did history at university. I did Latin. I did archaeology because I was just so fascinated with history, wanting to know more and more and more. And when I was small, I tried to find out who built Stonehenge. So I consulted the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I found that I was going from one article to another, and it was shuffling me around between articles. And I found out no one knows. They don't actually know. Yeah, it's an academic trick. They just shuffle you around, or they don't say who it is, who did it, who did whatever. So, you know, I went to uni and I did all the archaeology and all that, and did a PhD, and I wanted to start a history business. I started a history tour business. I was doing ghost tours. I was doing crime tours. They were very popular. The architecture tours, I have to say, not so popular, but yeah, people really love the ghosts and the crime and the pirates as well. We had a pirate thing as well. They stole all the gold from the treasury in 1854 and sailed away, never to be seen again. But yeah, I started this channel as a hobby, the channel Charles Koss, my YouTube channel, just as a diversion, really, and people started watching it, so I was very happy about that. And I always try and put a new theory across or a new insight across that's not being in the mainstream, that's a little bit out of the mainstream, but also makes some sense.
Very good. Now, talking about our hidden history, let's start with our human origins. How far back do you think this version of humanity goes? I mean, I know that we've seen plenty of cataclysms throughout our history that wiped out human civilizations, but how far can we trace back, I guess you could say, the first advanced civilization?
I think you can trace it a number of ways. You can trace it with a weather curve. You can see that it used to be as warm as it was today about 120,000 years ago and again at 40,000 years ago. You can also trace it with catastrophes. We know there was a catastrophe 30,000 years ago which wiped out mammoths, megafauna. I think it was toxic gases being released from waters upwelling out of the earth. That was the Great Flood. There was a catastrophe 60,000 years ago. So we know that there are these things interrupting human history, and that makes it kind of hard to trace where the civilization was. People like Graham Hancock, they talk about 10,000 BC, 10,500 BC, and newer monuments are commemorating that time period. It's so hard to trace. One of the reasons it's hard to trace is, I guess, that there's we could call it an exponential curve of destruction. The deeper you go down in the ground, the deeper you dig, the more likely whatever you're looking for will have been destroyed, the more likely it will have been recycled. Cities are always built on top of other cities. All the Egyptian cities today are built on top of the ancient Egyptian cities, so we don't really have the houses. We just have these pyramids out in the desert where people didn't really live. So that this all makes it difficult. And the further you go back in time, the harder it gets to look, because then suddenly the archaeologists are not allowed to dig because their supervisor says, well, hang on, why are you digging that far down? We all know there were no humans back then. We all know there was no civilization. What are you looking for? We're not anthropologists. We're not looking for fossils. We're just looking for buildings. So, yeah, it makes it all difficult. But I'm sure that we didn't live in the desert. We didn't live in, say, a field. You have to warm up even if you want to get to sleep. So we had houses going back as far as we've existed, and cities and everything.
Do you think that Atlantis was one of the first human civilizations?
I think Atlantis was one of the most recent human civilizations, and humans indeed go back maybe millions of years with their civilization, maybe even longer. I think humans are very old. I think the idea that humans are very young will prove to be inaccurate. We're finding Cro-Magnon remains, which are increasing age, 130,000 years in Europe. There was another 130,000-year-old Cro-Magnon remain in North Africa. And meanwhile, people have been saying for generations that, say, in America, there have only been people for 7,000 years, which doesn't make any sense at all, because people love to travel around. They love to hop in a boat. They love tourism. They love to travel around, look for a better climate, a better place, the land of milk and honey. Yeah.
So when we are talking about Atlantis, what can you tell us about the research you have done on it? You know, possible locations, it may be a time frame, and how advanced was it?
Well, Chris, I think it was. I think if we're looking at Atlantis, we're looking at something that controlled the Atlantic trade. And you have to look at what was being traded back in the day. And what was being traded was possibly metal from Lake Superior. We're talking possibly orichalcum. That might have been the site of the King Solomon mines, the orichalcum mines. And so they would have had a stranglehold on the Western Mediterranean, I think around Sardinia. Do you notice Sardinia is becoming very popular? People are conducting, all these ancient mystery people are conducting tours there. But I think it was located around UK, around the UK area. We have an island which has subsided considerably compared to the sea level in the past 10,000 years. In Wales, they've literally lost cities under the water within human memory. You have those famous cliffs of Dover. The reason they're there is the land keeps crumbling off into the sea, and the sea level has kept rising over the past 10,000 years. It's still going up as the Earth's warming. So I reckon UK is a good candidate for it. It's in the Atlantic. It was warmer before. We know from curves of temperature that it was warmer in the past. There could have been the old mammoths there, the old say elephants in Atlantis. I think UK is a good location. I've isolated a place called Old Sarum. It's a ringed fortress. Someone said, hey, that looks like Atlantis. And I said, well, yeah, it does look like Atlantis, doesn't it? 6 miles away is Stonehenge, and 6 miles away are other structures that Norman Lockyer pointed out on a map, and he said, that's funny that all these structures are 6 miles away from it. And I look up the Atlantis legend, and it says 6 miles away from the center of Atlantis was a wall. So are these structures built from some old wall? So I think for Atlantis, we're talking maybe within the last 10,000 years, this civilization controlling the Atlantic.
Let's talk about the technology that could have been possibly being utilized then. How advanced do you think it was, and you know, what kind of, I guess, technology were they using as an example for building some of these megalithic structures?
Well, lots of the technology for the megalithic structures is actually quite simple. We're talking about heating up rocks, driving wood into rocks, splitting them. But here's the thing, lots of these structures were already there. Lots of the materials for building them were already there. There's an old tradition that, except for the bluestones, everything at Stonehenge was already there. I think that this is based on some earlier ruin which we can't really understand, maybe a higher tech people. And I think the Atlanteans, because they're more within memory, were based on that. However, in Greece, where we have the Atlantis legend as well, we have ancient high tech described in the Iliad. For example, we have a race called the Phaeacians, and the Phaeacians had ships which had no men on board, and they could go anywhere on the planet, and they did not get shipwrecked. They didn't get lost. You could go anywhere in them. It said they knew every land, every city. And it's almost like describing a modern ship using GPS that pilots itself. So there was some advanced technology in the past, for sure. And I think we see that reflected in the ratios of the Great Pyramid as well. How did they know the size of the Earth and put the ratios into the Great Pyramid? Something unknown until the 18th century or the 17th century. So there was ancient knowledge back then, back in the day, for sure.
Do you have any theories on how they actually constructed, say, the Great Pyramid, and you know how these blocks were cut and formed?
Well, I think, you know, Joseph Davidovits has a really good theory in the geopolymer, in which he says that this is a type of dust. It's ground up stone. And it's been reformed into stone. The stone looks like limestone. It can last forever. It doesn't rot like concrete does. I would add to that and say maybe they had a mechanical power network, grinding machines, basically. And I would add further to that, if they had transatlantic trade in Peru, in Cuzco, what we see is stones which are extremely tightly fitting. But I've also noticed that you can see that some of the perfect facades have crumbled away and it's very rough inside. So it looks like there's a type of geopolymer facade which has been placed over rougher material. And so these people were the masters of this. They used strong acids to melt stone. They combined acids to make stronger acid. And then they were able to reform the stone. And this is a technique, you know, we don't do today. We're not really interested in using chemistry on stone, which is, I guess, alchemy, you could call it. So, there's all that, yeah.
Now, what would you say the purpose of the pyramids were? I know that there's plenty of different theories out there, and you have some that are a little different as well.
Yeah, so I've got a couple theories about the Great Pyramid, but they link together. So I think the pyramid is quite old. If it's a machine, I think it's a machine built, and this is a very radical theory. It's a bit wild, but I think it's true because it sort of fits the data. So we're looking at the data. I want to know what the truth is. I'm not here to spin any stories. So what we're looking at in the Great Pyramid is a huge block of stone, very narrow tunnels. I see a possible experimental device for doing interferometry. You shoot photons through narrow tunnels, you bounce them back, and you're inside a geologically stabilized huge structure. So you can check, you can look for gravitational anomalies, possibly even gravity waves. So we're talking maybe the Great Pyramid as built by a civilization the equal of the 20th century. It doesn't necessarily have to be more advanced than the 20th century. There was a mathematician and a historian called Stuccini who said that the pyramid is indeed built by a space-age people. He's done incredible calculations into the Great Pyramid, and he said that this was built by a space-age civilization. And the pyramid itself gives us so many clues. It's absolutely ridiculous. Newton thought that it betrayed in its dimensions the size of the planet, and so does Stuccini in the 20th century. But Newton read the ancient books, and he saw that the apothem of the Great Pyramid is one stadia, apparently. And the ancient Greeks, and the apothem is, you look at the pyramid from the top, there's a square, and you go to the side, not the corner, it's just the side, that's the apothem. It's one stadia, about 600 feet. According to the ancient Greeks, Eratosthenes, you multiply that by 250,000, you have the circumference of the Earth. And so these calculations are in ancient texts. They're in the Great Pyramid. So I think we're looking at a time capsule as well as a device for measuring an interferometer. Basically, it's a time capsule to tell us in the future that, oh, they had this ancient knowledge, this ancient wisdom. And I've made some discoveries about this. So, for example, we have two pyramids, two white pyramids, and then a red pyramid. It's the same as the Alpha Centauri star system. Two white stars, it's the nearest star, and then a smaller star, a red star. And because the red stone's right at the bottom of the Menkaure pyramid, the smallest of the three. In addition, and these stars, one is slightly smaller than the other, just like the Khufu and the Khafre pyramid. It's absolutely remarkable. In addition, by volume, the third star in that system is 10 times smaller than the other two. Same with the pyramid, the volume is 10 times smaller. In addition, we could have a proton and a neutron, because a proton and a neutron are slightly different sizes, and that's what we see in the Great Pyramid Complex. So I reckon they've somehow incorporated all this information into the pyramid complex with some computer, and they've come up with this. They said, this is the design to make a good time capsule to tell people in the future that we knew it all.
Do you think that there's correlations as well to the Orion constellation?
The Orion constellation is interesting because it actually supports the conventional ideas, because it relates the pyramid to 2400 BC. So it's therefore hard to relate the pyramid to a lost civilization if you're accepting the Orion correlation. It's a very conventional theory, and funnily enough, Zaki Hawass doesn't like it, even though it kind of supports his ideas. Although it does actually make the pyramid a bit more recent, because Khufu is about 2500s BC, and this, the Orion constellation, points to 2400 or 2300 BC. So it's a bit off with that as well. But if it is true, and maybe it is, I suppose it's fertility. It's Orion. It's the pyramid as a home for the green man, the resurrection god. Yeah, we don't know anything for sure when it comes to the Great Pyramid. Maybe, yes.
Now, how much research have you done on Pumapunku? I find that very fascinating. The way the stones were cut and the design and everything about it. It's absolutely amazing. What can you tell us about Pumapunku and maybe some of the purposes of it?
Well, Pumapunku is a very interesting structure. It's located quite close to the town of Tiwanaku, near the Tiwanaku ruins. And it seems to be the structure that precedes Tiwanaku. Tiwanaku seems to have been built from the Pumapunku rocks, which are more advanced. Everyone knows these are more advanced rocks. They're a slightly different civilization to the civilizations that use the Tiwanaku rocks. They don't seem to quite fit together at right angles, as some claim. So they're not exactly machined, but they could have been cut up by later Stone Age peoples. I think they're quite high tech, because there's a legend from the people who used to live there, the natives, and they said that gods flew in, they built the stones, and then there was some kind of war or something, or they weren't happy with their work, they overturned the stones, and then they flew out again, and they left them there. So immediately, the legends are associated with high tech and science. You know, you and me, we look at the stones, we're interested. We say, look, that's a bit too good for Stone Age. We say, what's going on? But we know there's something going on here. We don't know what the answer is. But I would say it's built in a high-tech way. I made a video saying this is a geopolymer. A few months later, the inventor of geopolymer, Davidovits, he actually flew over. He tested these stones and he said, yes, they're geopolymer. There's two types of geopolymer. There's a blue type. And there's a red type, which is being used in South America. So, and it's actually similar in Egypt as well. There was a red stone and a blue stone, as well as the limestone they were using. So, yeah, there's something funny going on. They were sharing information around the world in ancient times.
Yeah, that was just what I was about to ask you. It seems like they had this worldwide civilization or culture that shared, beliefs and spiritual beliefs and the technology to build these amazing structures that they built, and the similarities around the world are amazing.
Absolutely incredible, absolutely incredible. And even on the subject of Pumapunku, someone sent me a picture of Persepolis it's in Iran. It was the Persian capital. And there's actually stones which actually look like Pumapunku stones, which have been incorporated into the Persepolis structure. So even the ancient Persians may have built on a site where they saw there was all this old stone lying around, like Pumapunku, and they said, okay, that's a good place to build a city, because we've got all this stone here. You know, they left it here for us. Let's use it. You know, let's build with it. So, yeah, this was worldwide, yeah.
Now, do you think this knowledge originated from humans, or do you think it is off-planet knowledge that we gained from a different civilization or even from the spirit world?
Well, I don't know, but I suppose a bit of the spirit world, and also a bit of humans, I guess. The spirit world, insofar as humans seem to be able to exchange knowledge telepathically. There's a phenomenon where people discover things simultaneously around the planet. We all know about Nylon. Nylon is called New York, London, because it's discovered in two places simultaneously. So this is the 100 monkey effect. This is something that happens a lot. So there is telepathy, and if telepathy, why not spirits, which are the messengers of the telepathy? Telepathy is broadcast on a medium that physicists refuse to investigate, you know, so we have to talk about it with our nomenclature. But I think that getting back to your question, certainly, it was humans. I think it was humans with telepathy, sharing ideas. There's even an idea that Leonardo da Vinci was a kind of medium, and he was getting ideas. He was his mind was like a radio, just receiving ideas from the future, and that's why he was so creative. Creative people seem to get ideas which pop into their head, but where do they come from? We don't know.
It's a fascinating phenomenon where you can have some of these same ideas and inventions and things pop up around the world from, you know, different cultures at the same time. That's fascinating stuff. Now, what can you tell us about the Anunnaki? Were these actual, do you think they were human beings, or were they interdimensional beings? Aliens, there's so many theories on who or what the Anunnaki were.
Well, the Anunnaki in the ancient, they're in ancient kingdoms of Egypt, of Babylon. They ruled, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago in these king lists. But there's some question about whether they're talking about moon years or not, but that would still be about, you know, more than 10,000 years ago. The Anunnaki seem to be, they seem to be human-like, but they're always described as gods. They're not described as humans. And it's always a tradition that was also in ancient Greece that first there were gods ruling, and then there were demigods who lived with the gods, and they were the next rulers. So Hercules was part god, part demigod, and that was his claim to rulership, his claim to fame. So, and then we had the human rulers. So we have to ask why. And there's also the tradition that in the ancient times, there were giants. So were they gods because they were of large stature? We have, and I've pointed this out a few times, the 12-inch ruler. This is a foot-long ruler. Nobody's foot is 12 inches. What the heck is going on with that? So were the people of larger stature in the past? Were these the giants, the gods? Certainly giant people. If your whole country is a certain height and suddenly giants arrive with high technology, we would call them gods for sure. So I think they were humans. The alien thing, it's a bit harder to substantiate. I think that the UFOs might also be an earthly phenomenon, just a bit of a weird type of magnetism that physicists haven't realized yet or refuse to work on because they don't want to be laughed at by their sneering colleagues. So essentially... Yeah, I think they were humans.
And do you think that the these gods that were different names throughout different times, do you think that they were basically the same beings, just being represented differently through different time periods?
Sorry, I don't think I caught the last part of that.
Said, do you think these gods were just, they had different names through different time periods? They were just represented differently, but they're the same beings?
They have different names. For example, Anunnaki in Sumeria, the ancient Egyptians, they called them literally gods. And then after the gods, there were the spirits of the dead, which the Greeks would call the demigods. In Greece, there were the gods. They were the gods, literally, and yeah, they're basically this. It's the same in every country. In every ancient king list, there's actually giants. Even if you go to Britain and look up Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, it's an old British chronicle, and he says that before there were people living there, the land was ruled by giants. Then the people arrived and killed the giants. So these giants were all over the planet, and maybe they built some of these huge megaliths, the huge doorways, like at in Turkey, for instance, and at Baalbek.
So You mentioned earlier that you don't think the Anunnaki were aliens. What are your thoughts on the theories that at some point we had been genetically modified by some beings or something that gave us, you know, an intense jump in our intelligence and everything about us? It seemed to change very rapidly over a short period of time. So what are your thoughts about that?
I don't know for sure. And of course, it's only opinions, but, you know, they could well be aliens. But I think it's humans. And the reason it's humans is it's done the ancient genetic modification. I agree with that too. It's because it's recorded in the Bible. It's not recorded in an alien book. It's recorded in our own book, that there was an ancient genetic modification. So I think this was passed on from earlier humans. For example, in one video I pointed out that about the chromosomes, and this is very interesting. You see, we have 24 ribs which are paired up. And so 12, double 12 in other words. You take one away and God takes one away from Adam. Now we have 23 chromosomes. Take one from 24, we have 23 chromosomes. That's an interesting coincidence. And the Bible has always implied that Adam has been missing, is missing a rib because that was used to provide the DNA for Eve. And it's just like what the DNA shows. If you look at the chromosomes are paired alleles, and the male has a shorter a so-called Y chromosome on the 23rd allele. So Is this the missing rib? And they look like ribs. And I've said, look, this is ancient knowledge, but they couldn't understand it, so they called them ribs. And the numbers seem to match up. They look like ribs. There must have been pictures of how this was done. We have the caduceus, that ancient spiral, which looks like DNA. It's humans themselves who have had this knowledge. So I think it was humans. Maybe, but you know, who knows? Who really knows?
What are your thoughts on the elongated skull beings with red hair? Do you think that this was a form of the, I think it's called cradle headboarding, or do you think it's a natural phenomenon?
Oh, it's definitely a natural phenomenon. It's both, isn't it? It's a natural. I mean, back in the day, Erich von Däniken said that the ancient, he actually noticed, unlike all the other academics who said these were bound heads, he noticed that he said this was probably a natural phenomenon, because why would you do it? Why would you do it to your kids? Unless you were trying to become part of the higher classes, trying to give your kids every advantage in life, trying to put them into the aristocracy. And of course, Brian Forster had these genetic tests done, and he found that they were from the Black Sea, which is amazing. He thinks they traveled over the Pacific. And for sure, he's absolutely right. Arabs who traveled to southern Russia 1,000 years ago, they said that everyone there seemed to have red hair, and just like the red-haired mummy. So we have that's another corroboration. So for sure, it's natural. And there's some talk the Egyptians had something similar. They had some funny heads as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and I find it fascinating. You see it with the elite and the royalty that had this feature of the elongated skull and the red hair.
Indeed, and if they've got red hair, that means they've got very light skin, so blue blood. You go to the National Portrait, and there's another thing. If you go to the National Portrait Gallery in London, and it shows you portraits of every great historical figure in British history. And I was thinking, you know what? They all look the same. They're all redheads with the same sort of eyes. It's really fascinating, you know. So that's continued down.
So do you think that it was just kind of bred out of the elites eventually, that to where that it wasn't a feature anymore?
Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose they would have run out of other people to breed with, basically. And this happened with Easter Island. So the Easter Islanders, the long ears, who were the redheads, they seem to have been ruling Peru. And some of them, there was a coup or something, and some of them decided to leave, hop off it, go into the Pacific. And this is the Viracocha legend. Viracocha has left, he's gone to the Pacific, but he'll come back one day. And boom, a few centuries after Christ, you have Easter Island set up. And these were all redheads with long ears, elongated ears. They used to do the same thing in Asia, elongated ears. Buddha has an elongated ear as well. I guess maybe they ran short of numbers. And so, yeah, they had no choice.
And earlier you had mentioned the giants. Let's talk a little bit about giants. How tall do you think some of these beings actually were? And do you think that they were always around since, you know, the earliest human civilization? You know, how did they come about? How did giants, you know, come to be on our planet?
Well, I suppose every creature back in the day was larger before 30,000 years ago. 30,000 years ago, the megafauna were wiped out. Now they're even testing dinosaur bones with carbon datings, and they're dating to about 30,000 years. And the establishment says, oh, that's an error. But look, this could have been the bird megafauna. There were still, as far as I'm concerned, there are still dinosaur birds, if you look at the dodo and the emu. But anyway, if you have large animals, the large animals would have supported the large humans. Everything was larger due to an unknown mechanism. We don't know what it was, which made everything larger. It's like sometimes, you know, you have a nuclear explosion and then all plants are large, which grow nearby. It's something that's periodical. It's something that pops up on the earth and then it goes away again. And then all the animals become small, the plants become smaller. Weather changes, yeah.
Now, how tall do you think they were?
If we look at the Cro-Magnons which many Cro-Magnons have been dug up and you know, dating to 60,000 years or 70,000 years, and we're talking, you know, 6'2", 7 foot, sometimes a bit more than 7 foot, but I'd say around 7 foot would be the height of the giants. If we look at Goliath in the Bible, I believe is described as 9 foot and several inches. So we're talking someone bloody huge. This is a bit weird. But then again, there is a door at Baalbek, which is more than 10 feet tall. So, and we don't know when Baalbek was from. It could be unbelievable.
Well, haven't we found bones that are up to 14, you know, that have been estimated to been up to 14 feet tall?
I've been told that either that this story is real or that this story was made up by newspapers. So I don't know for sure about this. And I don't know if the bones even still exist. Apparently they don't exist because they've been thrown out of museums. And that's true. They have been destroyed because museums do destroy stuff all the time. Even your famous artist, Edward Hopper, I believe he did Nighthawks. His wife donated all her works to the museum. The museum destroyed all of them. So museums destroy things all the time. And so because of that, we don't know. You know, we don't really know. But, yeah.
Yeah, that's really amazing. I mean, you hear the accounts of, like you said, the museums just getting rid of the evidence of this fascinating history. And I had Michael Cremo on, and he tends to believe that they could have been, you know, up to 14 feet tall, you know, some of the larger giants. And I find that amazing.
Yes. Well, you know what, it's certainly not impossible because of those dimensions, you know, Goliath's dimension, the 9 foot, described in the Bible. You look at the size of megaliths, you look at the size of the pyramids, and you think, look, it's not just machines. There has to be some manual labor involved. And us normal humans can't really do that. That's a lot of damn hard work. So even just looking at the pyramids, ancient peoples would have thought, well, you know, built by the giants. And they always said the Great Pyramid was built before the flood.
Now, I've also wanted to talk about these doors that seem to go to nowhere. These ancient doorways that were built into mountains are just, they stand out and they just go nowhere. But, you know, it seems like they should go somewhere. What are the purpose of some of these doors that we see all over the world?
I believe Brian Forster made a few videos about this, saying they were sort of a portal, an interdimensional spirit place. You can communicate with the spirits there. To me, some of these doors could be literal shrines. The author Robert Temple, he says that the ancient Egyptians actually treated light as if light could go through things. So if you look at the Temple of Karnak, it's set up so that there are actual doors and walls blocking what the light would illuminate on solstices. But that light would actually illuminate certain reliefs if there was no wall there. So, and the ancient Egyptians had this mystical idea about light going through things, like stone. So, and here's the thing. If you look at the ancient books of Hermes, I'm not talking about the tablets of Hermes, which I believe were a channel, but the Book of Thoth, the Hermes Trismegistus, which was translated several hundred years ago into English. And the ancient Egyptians believed that thought itself goes through everything. It penetrates everything. It's everywhere. And you can use your own thought to acquire information in that way. So for sure, I think maybe they were for thought, for meditation, something like that.
What are your thoughts that they could possibly be some type of ancient stargate that I've had... I forget his name. He was on recently, and he believes that they could actually travel, that they were actually a sort of portal.
Yeah. Anything's possible. If it's a stargate, it's associated with a stellar alignment astrologically with planets and with other things. So those people, they looked at the astrology, and they looked at where the planets were, and when there were certain alignments, at favorable 40 degree angles, 90 degree angles are bad, but 40 degree angles I think are the good ones. Then they could meditate, and they could travel. They could meet the ancestors, who, according to every ancient tradition, they live up there in the stars. You know, their spirits go up there. So yeah, it's possible, isn't it? Yeah.
Now, when you look at the story of the Great Flood and all the ancient texts, the story of Enlil and Enki, it seems that these cataclysms were intentionally caused to sort of clean up a mess that was made, or they don't like the way humanity is going. What are your thoughts on that?
I think absolutely. I think in the Bible, the two arcs have been confounded together because they might have been one story. For example, we have an Ark of the Covenant, which is a box, and which is God. And we have also an ark which was built to save the species, to save everything on the planet as a time capsule. And we all know you can't put two of everything on a boat. So I believe the story of the box has been mixed up with the story of the boat, and the box might have been a genetic laboratory. It might have had genetic information of two of every kind easily. If they travel the world getting DNA, yes, you could fit that in a box, the ark. But you couldn't fit that on a boat if you put the species literally onto the boat. So the ancient people saw there was a catastrophe coming. Maybe there was nuclear war. You know, that's a good way of explaining nuclear war later on for future generations who can't understand the nuclear war. Like, oh, the ancient gods, they were angry at the people, so they decided to wipe everyone out. That's a good way of explaining that to the kids. It might have been taught in schools, you know, generations after the nuclear war when it all went back to the Stone Ages.
Do you think that at some point in our history, with some of our most advanced civilizations, that we actually had the ability to travel the stars and go off planet?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You look in the ancient texts from ancient India, and they literally talk about this stuff. They literally talk about wars in the heavens, wars in outer space. A war in the heaven is in every ancient text. I think ancient astronauts were the legend of the fallen angel, which is the wise guy, the wise one, the Buddha figure, the giant. He fell to earth, entombed in rock when he crashed down into the planet. It's in every ancient lore, and it's just fascinating. It's just so endlessly fascinating. Yes, we had space travel in the Mahabharata, the ancient Indian text. It talks about the craft of Ravana. This craft of Ravana, it was as big as a city, and it could actually fly into the ocean. And the opposing force actually had to evaporate the ocean in order to get at that craft and destroy it. And it talks about these huge flying cities falling out of the sky, missiles, anti-missile missiles, nuclear weapons, world destroyer weapons. What's a world destroyer weapon? It's a nuclear weapon. You know, this is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, and it also lends to the theory that there was a massive nuclear war on Mars, that we could have had an ancient civilization there as well that was forced to come to Earth at some point because of this massive nuclear war.
I totally agree with that, 100%. We're even getting echoes of that today. You know, even telepathically, you mentioned the spirit world before. Look at C.S. Lewis. He came up with just that scenario, and people have been coming up with just that scenario throughout the 20th century. Percival Lowell talked about a civilization struggling on Mars, and we are the descendants. This idea has popped into everyone's heads. Recently, I forget the name, there was a professor in the news, you might have seen it, and he's a zoologist, an entomologist, sorry, studies insects, and he's seen insects in Martian fossils. He's been studying them for 40 years, and he says there are insects on Mars. So, of course that's possible. Insects are robotic-like things, and yes, they could have shared them with Earth. That if that's true, that's proof of that. Isn't that proof of that scenario?
Now, when you look at modern-day secret societies and the people that control our planet, do you think that they are actually ruling with this ancient knowledge that has been passed down from the ruling class since the beginning of our advanced ancient civilizations?
Well, we're in David Icke territory, but I actually agree with him. He's a very good author. It's like reading War and Peace, some of his books, but I really have to agree with a lot of what he's saying. Stuff that he wrote in the 90s, I read it today. I'm reading a book now, stuff that he wrote in 1995. It's all come true. So, I wouldn't put it past them for sure. He talks about this happening. He talks about a mechanism of this happening via the spirit world, into like maleficent spirits interfering. So, for example, in the Masonic ceremony, itself invokes black magic in a way, which invokes the spirits. The spirits come in whether you like it or not. We all know the story of the Ouija boards. The spirits come in whether you like it or not, whether you believe in them or not. It screws your life up. So for that reason, there could be, if they're an ancient society going back a long way, it would have to be regulated in a way, or it would change. It would be regulated by the spirit world.
And, you know, it seems that the ancient cultures used to openly practice magical practices. At some point, the ruling class didn't want everybody having these abilities, practicing this, so they suppressed it, kept all this knowledge for themselves. And that's why we see, I guess, the suppression of these ancient knowledge and the ancient knowledge of ourself and the abilities that we used to have. It seems to have been all put under lock and key so that we won't have access to it anymore.
It does seem that way, doesn't it? Because everything that is magic, or anything that is strange or unknown, seems to be sneered at, which is an interesting thing. We have an academic community which is discrediting things simply by sneering at them, and not offering any counterpoint, any counterbalance, any counter argument at all. Not even acknowledging the existence of a phenomena of magic, or a phenomena of the unusual. They say the phenomena itself doesn't exist, which is madness, you know. So for sure there's a suppression happening in the world. That's very plain. It's been happening for such a long time that as you say, Chris, we've lost touch of our innate telepathic magical abilities, our intuition, our intuitive abilities. Do you know Aborigines can find each other thousands of kilometers away? They can actually meet each other just with their minds. It's amazing what we have.
And it seems that not only that, but our psychic abilities, our magical abilities, all these extraordinary things that we used to be able to do was combined with the ancient technology that they had so that we could do extraordinary things with not only the technology that we had, but with our own abilities.
Oh, indeed, indeed. And we had such a confidence in the past. Our ancestors had such a tremendous confidence. If you look at the Great Pyramid and you look at the fact that it's complete, it shows that these people could build whatever they wanted to build. And they also wanted to tell us, hey, you guys in the future who might not share our abilities, who might be in a Stone Age, who might be suppressed by some force, you can do it too. And you can do what we did. All the ratios and knowledge are in there for you to use. And, yeah, you look at the ancient people and what they built was they built as if there was nothing stopping them. And so they must have had some spiritual impetus for this, some confident force behind them.
Earlier you were talking about Stonehenge. Let's talk a little bit about that. That's still very much a mystery to me, the purposes for it. So what can you tell us about Stonehenge, you know, the purposes and how it was used?
Stonehenge is very fascinating. I made some discoveries, which I put up forth on my channel, and I said it's basically a snake temple. There was snake worship before. If we look at the horseshoe, it's not a circle, it's a horseshoe. There's a Trilithon horseshoe. There's another Sarsen circle around it. And in ancient times, it was thought that snakes mate via the mouth. So what we have here is a cosmic recreation. We have this in Viking mythology where we have Jormungandr, the huge snake wrapped around the earth. And when it lets go of its tail, the world will end because it's no longer recreating the earth. The snake we've seen is the most primitive organism recreating the earth time and again. If we look at Stonehenge, it's lunar. In ancient time, it's for lunar eclipses, also solar, but mainly lunar eclipses as well. The moon goddess was a snake goddess. The moon goddess was also a bird goddess. So birds were also quite high up there. I think it was an eclipse temple as well. If you look at all stone circles, they're actually eclipse shaped. And Avebury is an eclipse shape, like a diamond ring. It's not a complete circle. And in addition, stone circles are almost orbital. They're never circular. They're ovoids, but they're not even ovoids. They're egg shaped, or they're eclipse shaped. They're diamond ring effect shaped. So there's so much. There's so much. Of this going on. Alexander Thom, he was a great British mathematician. He said, these guys had really high mathematics when they built these stone circles because this is so mathematical. But it's almost like an orbital shape or an egg shape. We don't know what their ancient religion was, but it's absolutely incredible. And there's a lot more to Stonehenge, which is not being discussed. It's not allowed to be discussed. If I started discussing it in the academic world, I wouldn't be in the academic world at all. I wouldn't have any place there. In fact, I don't have a place there because I'm talking all these weird theories. But you can only talk about what your predecessor has talked about, basically.
And I'm glad you brought that up. Why do you think modern day academia suppresses this information and, you know, tends to, I guess, make researchers like yourself and all these great people like Brian Forrester, Graham Hancock, you know, they make them seem like tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorists, but in reality, they're bringing information to the table that's true. It's real. It's stuff that they would never offer in modern day academia, but it's the way things really were. Why do you think they're suppressing this so much?
Well, academia itself is a curious paradox. So on the one hand, you're supposed to publish in order to advance your position. But on the other hand, you're not allowed to really make too radical discoveries or you're going to be sneered at. And if you get sneered at, that's it. So it's really weird. I remember in archaeology class back in, I think, 2004, the archaeologist, she was actually talking about some alternate theory of what happened to the Egyptian army, which was chasing Moses. And she said, this guy was talking about a tsunami and all this. you know, and she started laughing. And I was thinking to myself, well, we just had a tsunami which wiped out a million people in Asia. So why are you laughing at that? This is real phenomena. And these guys, they live at their desk, and that's their world. You know, that's their world. They're desk bound. Once a year, they get to do some excavation for a couple of weeks at the end of the year, then they're back to uni working hard, but and sneering at each other again. This is their system, right? And also, about half of academics seem to have psychological issues. You could say ego problems. So they sneer at each other in order because they're insecure. In order to you know, they're competing. It's like a girl's room, you know. At a girls' high school or something like that, you know what I mean? It's like
I'm sure some of them also have fear of, you know, losing their tenure, being shunned from the community, you know, basically losing everything that they've worked for just for presenting an idea that doesn't fit into that bubble.
Absolutely, absolutely. They have a... This is the problem with academics. Once they have a tenure position, they didn't get that position because they were good teachers. Most of them are not good teachers at all. They got that through by doing. They're good at publishing things on their own, and they're really not the best people for the job of teaching, or even of researching. They have very limited, like you say, they're in a bubble. They have very limited ideas. And they operate within this paradigm, the paradigm set down by their predecessors. And if they go outside that paradigm or outside their speciality, for example, archaeologists can't talk about astronomy because they're not qualified to. We had Norman Lockyer 100 years ago wrote a brilliant book about archaeoastronomy in Egypt, ignored because they don't understand it. They go outside the bubble, they'll make themselves look foolish, so they say Norman Lockyer must be wrong. Simple as that.
Now, do you see any of this changing in our near future? I know a lot of people are waking up to this. You know, a lot of people that I never thought would come around to realizing some of these truths are saying, oh, you know what? I think that is BS. And, you know, they're starting to listen to some of these independent researchers like yourself. Do you think that modern day academia will ever adopt this and change?
I think they might. The internet might increase the pace of them changing, because certainly these days you want to look something up online. People don't even Google anymore; they look it up on YouTube. They search what they want on YouTube, and they see an independent person describing exactly what they want, describing exactly what they need to know, giving a tutorial or whatever, and they think, I never learned this before. The television didn't tell me this. The newspapers didn't tell me this. What are we paying them for anyway? So, yeah, people are definitely waking up, and it'll force the academics to change. They're watching the Google, and they see the way that the trend's heading as well, so they'll hopefully change too. But, yeah, slowly. I mean, look at cosmology, electric universe, and all that. So slow.
Yeah, there is a lot of encouraging things happening right now. Makes me excited for the future. And Charles, thank you so much. That was amazing information. Thanks you for coming on tonight. Before you head out, tell everybody where they can find all your work.
Thanks, Chris. It was a blast. You can find my work on Amazon. Just search Charles Koss on Amazon. I wrote a few books. My good one is Confessions of the Gods. That's really good, really readable about the ancient high-tech civilization and evidence for it in ancient texts. And also check my work on YouTube, Charles Koss. I'm making a video every so often.
Very good. Well, thanks again, and you have an excellent night.
Thanks, Chris.